All right, 54198, Goodloe versus State, Mr. Petty, Mr. Hattelstab. Did I pronounce your name right for a change?
Yes, thank you.
Finally, after being on the bench for over three and a half years, congratulations, Justice Jerry. Mr. Petty, go ahead for Mr. Goodloe.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justice Cherry, Justice Seda, Justice Gibbons. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Petty. I'm with the Washington County Public Defender, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellant, Delwin Goodloe. There were a number of issues raised in the briefs, but I'd like to focus my attention this morning on jury selection issues, in particular the Batson issue that arose below, and then, if time permits, some comments about the judicial commentary that was made below. Having said that, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
I want to flesh out the Batson issue that occurred below. As this court knows, the United States Supreme Court in Batson v. Kentucky said that the use of peremptory jury challenges on the basis of race violates the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. And as this court observed in VMOFO v. State, Batson error is structural error. And as such, if it exists, then it mandates reversal of the conviction and a remand for new trial. And that is precisely what we are seeking this morning with regards to Mr. Goodloe and, by extension, obviously, Mr. Smith, the co-defendant, although I do not argue for Mr. Smith this morning. So I want to flesh out that Batson issue. The test, as this court knows, is when a Batson matter is raised, the proponent has to show or make a prima facie showing of purposeful discrimination on the part of the opponent, in this case, the state. Then the state is called upon to offer justifications, race-neutral justifications, for the challenges that have been made to the non-white jury member. And then it is the court's obligation, the trial court's obligation, to engage in to use some of the language from the cases, a sensitive inquiry of all the relevant circumstantial and direct evidence to make a determination whether or not there has, in fact, a showing of purposeful discrimination has been made. That last test is an obligation of pivotal role held by the trial court. And the issue that's been raised on the Batson context in this case is the fact that below, Judge Kosach really didn't engage in any of or take under consideration or actually do that which was required of him, assume that pivotal role, to quote Justice Alito from Schneider v. Louisiana, that is his to do in making that third step Batson determination. Now, to get there, we have to look at the second step Batson determination. We have to look at the Batson error briefly, so I want to review that. Batson came up in jury selection during the selection of an alternate juror by the name of Curtis Butler. Now, I need to take a step away from that and just say this about that. In the answering brief, the state kind of suggests that maybe because we're talking about an alternate juror as opposed to a regular juror, maybe the Batson analysis isn't as significant or as applicable. And I respectfully disagree. Because we are talking about an equal protection analysis, it does not matter whether that violation occurs during the selection of a regular juror or an alternate juror. Moreover, under our statutes, 176.061, which sets forth the qualifications for the alternate juror, it basically sets forth, as I put in my reply brief, the fact that the alternate juror has to meet all of the qualifications of the regular juror, is entitled to the same kinds of rights and privileges as the alternate juror. And in fact, if it comes to pass that, or excuse me, the regular juror, and if in fact it comes to pass that the alternate juror is going to serve, then that jury must start their deliberations anew as if a new jury was constructed. So the fact that the Batson error occurs during the selection of an alternate juror as opposed to a regular juror really isn't a determinative factor. It is the entire process that comes into play with regards to the Batson issue. So in this case, Mr. Butler, the state exercises a peremptory challenge to exclude the only African-American on that particular panel. Mr. Goodloe's counsel makes an objection under Batson, and the state explains that, well, Mr. Butler had some involvement with law enforcement in California, and in Nevada, and that's his race-neutral reasons. Co-counsel points out at that time that the prosecutor has actually utilized three of his first four peremptory challenges during regular jury selection process to exclude three other non-white potential jurors, and they were Mr. Ruiz, Mr. Torres, and Mr. Chang, two Hispanics and a person of Asian descent. The judge never asks the state, and Mr. Hattelstadt concedes this in his answering brief, the judge never asks the state to justify or explain or give any kind of reasons why he excluded those three persons in the exercise of his peremptory challenges. Later, the prosecutor, perhaps sensing that he needs to make a record, explains to the court or offers up as his after-the-fact rationalizations that the reasons that he excluded these three individuals was based on their age and lack of education. Now, if you look at the record, if you go read the jury selection process, and in particular, that portion that deals with the examination by the prosecutor, nobody, including these three, were ever asked questions with regards to their age or their education, and never were explored, and it was never explored with any of these individuals, how that might disqualify them or otherwise affect their ability to be a fair and impartial juror in this particular case. But he offered those questions up. But the significant thing here, and this goes to the third part of the Batson test, is that the judge never credited those explanations. The judge simply said, thank you, and called for the jury. So he never actually adopted those rationalizations offered up by the prosecution. Now, this court in Diamopo and other cases has said that when it comes to that third step, it will give great deference to the factual determinations by the trial court. Well, I suggest to you that there were no factual determinations by the trial court vis-a-vis those three individuals.
Mr. Petty, let me ask you this. Because this is a troubling issue, it comes up a lot and all, but was there any record made in the court on these three individuals you're describing here, that two of them had Hispanic names and one had an Asian name, that they were in fact Hispanic or Asian? Was that made part of the record here, or is this all based on their last names?
I believe there's a comment by co-counsel, Mr. McKenna, in the record, and I would have to search the record, but I believe there's a comment in there where he specifically says two Hispanics and one Oriental, I think, is the language that he uses. So, and nobody disputes that. There's no one says, well, wait a minute, that's not true. This is actually, you know, Mr. Torres, our German neighbor from, you know, Germany. No one does that. So I think the record is sufficient to show that in fact, these individuals were of a minority class. And the judge didn't explore that in any event. But here's the thing that I think this court needs to take into consideration. Now, when it comes to the factual determinations by a court, the court will defer to those factual determinations, gives deference to the trial court. But justifications offered up by the prosecutor are subject to de novo review on appellate review. And in that regard, you can look at the totality of the record. And here is an interesting point that was made to Judge Kosach below, but completely ignored by him. But I think it's salient, and this court should consider it. And that is this, and this is at page 269 of volume 4 of the joint appendix. Co-counsel points out to Judge Kosach that with regards to the alternate jurors, this goes back to Mr. Butler, with regards to the alternate jurors that were under consideration, there were six persons named. And in fact, at page 266 of volume 4, Judge Kosach identifies them in order as follows: Horton, Hinman, Holland, Miller, Porter, and Butler. That means Butler, the African-American, is number six. And what co-counsel points out to Judge Kosach is, Judge, mathematically, Mr. Butler would never have been seated. It doesn't matter how the parties would have exercised their three peremptory challenges, because you had the prosecutor and two defense counsel. It didn't matter how they exercised their peremptories as to those first five jurors, whether it was number one, number two, and number three, or number one, number five, number three, and number five, or any combination you want to make. How those would have been exercised, Mr. Butler, because he was the sixth juror, never would have been seated. He was mathematically, it was mathematically impossible for Mr. Butler to be seated. So this court should wonder, and this goes to the heart of my argument, what would possess a prosecutor to exercise the only peremptory challenge that he has to take out the only African-American juror when that individual, by the mere process of mathematical elimination, isn't going to be seated anyway? I submit to this court that actions speak louder than words, that when that prosecutor exercised that peremptory challenge for somebody who was not going to be seated anyway mathematically, that showed that his purpose, his intent, was discriminatory. And then you take that as a bit of circumstantial evidence and you apply that to the other three individuals that were excluded, Mr. Torres, Mr. Ruiz, and Mr. Chang, and this court can, under de novo review, find that those justifications, and in particular with regards to Mr. Butler, but I submit across the board, were constituted a pretext to take individuals, non-white individuals, minority members, off of the jury. And as such, it constitutes an equal protection violation that was a stain on the fundamental fairness of the trial below, and it is a stain on the appeal that is before you, and this court has an obligation to remove that stain by reversing the convictions below and remanding for a new trial. The Batson error, I think, is clear. Purposeful discrimination is clearly shown by the record by virtue of the exercise of that peremptory challenge against Mr. Butler. And as a result, this court should send this matter back for a new trial. And I don't want to use up all the rest of my time because I want to be able to respond to Mr. Halstead because I know he is a very smart attorney and I'm going to want to be able to listen to what he says. So, okay. If you don't mind.
We'll have you reserve 3:26.
Thank you.
Mr. Halstead.
Thank you, Justice Cherry, Justice Gibbons, and Justice Seda. Good to be back to the court today. My name is Gary Hattelstedt with the Wash County DA's office. I represent the respondent in this case. I want to start off by just mentioning a few things about the Batson claim, and there's lots of other issues in the case. I'm happy to address them if you're interested in discussing the merits, but this is the big issue in this case for sure, without a doubt. Mr. Petty made the point about the alternate jurors, and the thing that strikes my mind here when I read this and have read it many times since is how is it possible for there to be structural error, which is the premise of Batson, when the challenge is to somebody that will not and did not hear the case. How can that be a structural error? That was my only point. I think there's other issues in this case with respect to whether or not this is subject to some sort of harmless error review, whether it should be prejudicial. Mr. Petty said de novo. The cases from the United States Supreme Court say clearly erroneous. I don't think it makes any difference in this particular case what the standard of review is. But the thing that needs to be kept in mind, I think, and I'm going to point out that I'm going to split some hairs here. I want to parse a few things, but it's important for the procedure. First of all, Goodlow never challenged the three jurors that were offered up as the pattern of discrimination. The challenge only came out when Mr. Butler was challenged. Mr. McKenna, who happened to be Mr. Smith's lawyer, said, hey, here's these other jurors. That shows a pattern. At that point, the prosecutor offers his explanation, and I disagree with Mr. Petty on this point. There was an analysis under the third step of Batson. He said the prosecutor has offered a rational, logical explanation. And the judge says no racial motivation here. I think that comports with step number three as far as Mr. Butler is concerned. Now, as the case unfolded and the prosecutor was listening to Mr. McKenna make another speech, it dawned on his mind, at least this is what the record seems to suggest, I'd better make a comment here about race-neutral grounds on the other potential jurors, the ones that he challenged with his peremptory challenge, and no Batson objection was ever leveled against those jurors. They were cited only as evidence of a pattern. They were not on their own.
Was there anything in the record that these people were, in fact, minorities, these three people other than their last names?
I don't think that's in dispute. The prosecutor didn't say anything about them not being members of a minority and therefore beyond the scope of Batson. I think that's not an issue here.
Okay.
I appreciate the concern, but I don't think that's the issue here. I think that's a given. They're members of a minority. The two of those people, Mr. Butler and I think it was Mr. Chang, Butler clearly had non-racial reasons for his excusal because he had animosity toward the police, had run-ins with the police, and so forth. Chang had a case with our office. So those are clearly non-racial grounds. But to me, the procedure in this case is what's important. There were no specific objections on Batson for those three jurors that Mr. Pingerman, the prosecutor, mentioned later. They were cited only as evidence of a pattern. And when he spoke to the Butler matter, he says, there has been no showing of a pattern in this case, but be that as it may, and then he offers his race-neutral explanation as required by step two of Batson. And then the judge made a ruling. So as far as Butler is concerned, the record is fine. There's not a Brady violation there, regardless of it, whether it goes to an alternate juror or not. So Butler, I think, is fine. The question here comes down to the other three. And as I suggested, I do not, well, at least I respectfully submit in this case, that the record was not made as a Batson challenge to any of these three jurors.
Well, why would a district attorney challenge one Asian, one African-American, and two Hispanics? I mean, especially in Washoe. You don't have a lot of minorities serving on jurors. We don't have it in Clark County either, to tell you the truth. Why would the trial attorneys do that? They're asking for trouble and gives you a tough time to come up here and try to explain why four minorities are knocked off a jury, one who wasn't even going to serve.
Well, for the same reason that you, as a trial lawyer, would have peremptorily challenged a juror. There's something about their experience, their past, their level of education, their run-ins with the DA's office, and animosity with the police. That's
when
why.
When you talk about youth, I've seen in many jury trials where there's youthful Caucasians and inexperienced Caucasians. I mean, these reasons don't seem race-neutral to me. Why are they race-neutral?
They would be significant in this case if that was the basis for the Batson argument. But there's no claim in this case that the prosecutor kept young people on and took the young person off. That would be a pretext. But there's no evidence of that.
Well, I wish there had been an evidentiary, or at least not an evidence hearing, but a hearing outside the presence of the jury, and I don't think there was, on Torres and Ruiz and Chang as they were being challenged. But, you know, unfortunately, I'm a judge now and a justice, and I can't go back to the courtroom and tell people how to do this stuff. But again, I can't understand how the defense attorneys were sitting on their hands in this. And I'll have to ask Mr. Petty that. But they seem to be sitting on their hands on this. You make sense in what you say. You know, the fact that the district attorney then brings it up again, they must have had some type of inclination that there was something could be wrong, and they covered it was a CYA. They did a good job on that.
Well, that's my point. I mean, if the court is not willing to, you know, carefully parse through the record and not willing to perhaps look at step three as a potential argument for harmless error or lack of prejudice, you're going to reverse. But I think you have to look at the procedure and the context in which the controversy arose. And, you know, the record, it's not the state's burden of proof to show racial discrimination. We offer our race-neutral justification or rationale, and the judge will weigh that, as he did with Mr. Butler. So, again, I say, as far as Butler's concerned, this record is fine. But if you want to go beyond that and show, you know, discriminatory intent, let's see a little bit more evidence. And as I pointed out, there may very well have been a handful of young people on this jury. I don't know. But nobody, as you pointed out, nobody spoke up and said, juror number six is 22, didn't graduate from high school. This is a complex case, Your Honor. We got felony murder, we got aiding and abetting, we have all these experts who are going to testify. I need someone that can think through this material.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Halstead, move on to another subject. Judge Kosash's comments in the opening charge to the jury. I would assume the three of us would conclude that they're not appropriate comments about Hitler and Ho Chi Minh and all this stuff, you know, to introduce the jurors to this particular case. But in view of instruction number 15, is this error harmless? Jury instruction 15 was about the disregarding the comments from the court and
right,
et cetera.
Well, I agree. Should not draw a direct comparison between notorious villains and murder defendants. But the question is, and maybe I beg the question, is that what happened? I say the answer is no.
I know all three of us have read the transcript of his comments, so tell us what you think he said.
Well, I can tell you exactly what he said. And again, context is everything. He just gets done questioning a juror about being impartial, not liking the facts of a case, and having a bias. And then later on, he says, and this is on page 143 of volume 4, I can't say I hate Adolf Hitler. I can't say I hate Ho Chi Minh. I fought in the jungles against his boys. Do you see what I'm saying? So we don't go there. I don't know if I hate the NVA or Viet Cong now, even though they killed my men and wounded me. Right at this minute, right before you hear anything, can you apply the law? Can you give the defendant the presumption of innocence? I think you have to keep in context. In the abstract, these comments are inappropriate. But I think the entire point of the exercise was to make sure the jury understands they have to be impartial regardless of their emotion. And that, I would respectfully submit, was the point of the exercise.
I realize it's the point. It's just how he gets to the point is our concern.
I agree. I agree.
And I want to follow with that because we would review, in this case, in response to those comments, of course, there was a motion for a mistrial that was made, and we would review that on an abuse of discretion standard.
Right.
For better or for worse, the three of us have all been trial judges. And I will tell you that these comments are deeply troubling to me. And I don't like to second guess our brethren, especially on the abuse of discretion standard. But I can't imagine how this didn't affect the jury pool in this instance.
Well, I think you have to look at, let's just say, not just from the standpoint of the merits, because the comments were improper, but if we want to look for the effect, these are just a few things I pointed out to myself. He did not draw a direct comparison between these villains and the defendants.
Did he have to? And I'm not being sarcastic.
I understand, right. I agree. Does he have to? Probably not. But if we're in the context of an abuse of discretion and reversible error versus a harmless error, these are things that you could probably think about and reject the claim on the merits. That's my point. Bad comments for sure. I'm not even going to debate that. I scratch my head every time I read a transcript from Judge Kosach, frankly. Again, not linked to the evidence in this case. To use the examples to underscore the call for impartiality, reminded the jury to decide the case on the facts, not emotion. And then he gave instructions. Now, you remember, there was a motion for a mistrial, and then after the motion was finished and he denied it, he came back out on the record and admonished the jurors about this. So I think, again, the comments are improper. They cannot be defended in the abstract, but you have to take it in the context of the entire presentation. So we have improper comments designed for a proper purpose, maybe not the best means to that end, and then you have cautionary jury instructions.
I know that we've encouraged judges in civil and criminal cases when things like this happen to give the cautionary instructions, so we have to give them some credit for that.
Correct. And he asked some of the jurors after that, and I think one of the jurors excused himself or said, yeah, I can't be fair. I think that's we may not agree with the means, but certainly the end was correct. And the means used were not prejudicial in this case, at least on this issue. So that's how I would treat these improper or allegedly improper comments from Judge.
Wouldn't have mentioned anything about severance?
Do I want to?
Yes,
I do.
It was raised by, let's see, one defendant raised this, objected to severance, and the other didn't.
Right. But Mr. Petty's client raised the claim.
Right.
It's properly before the court.
Right.
Your Honor, of course, I respectfully submit that the motion for a severance was properly denied in this case. It really boiled down to three things. Were there antagonistic defenses, and were the antagonistic defenses so prejudicial as to deny a fair trial, the ability to present evidence, or to exercise a trial right? There's also an allegation about the inability to actually put on a defense. And frankly, I wonder what that defense was. Mr. Goodlow testified. I mean, what defense was not put on? What ability to put a defense on was thwarted here? There's also a mention of a second prosecutor. And to be sure, Mr. McKenna tried his case through the cross-examination of Mr. Goodlow, but that was well into the trial. Clearly, the trial judge has a duty, continuing obligation, to look for prejudice from a misjoinder.
Did the defense attorney raise that issue during trial, that there should be a severance?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did the defense attorney raise that issue once things started happening in the trial?
No, but I won't argue to you that they have to. The judge has a continuing duty. But the answer to your question is never raised again. And even though the antagonistic defense is a clear argument here, because they were each pointing the finger at the other, and to accept one defense would be to convict the other and vice versa. That's why they're antagonistic. But all the cases in the post-Zafiro era do not require, you know, automatic severance or a per se prejudice from antagonistic defenses. There has to be more.
Let me jump to the other issue. Well, there's other issues, but the one about the general verdict form for first-degree murder, not breaking it out between felony murder and premeditated murder. I assume your position is that's the law in the state today. I know this has come up several times with us recently, where you have these felony murder cases, and the Ney case kind of has a new slant on this. So what's your thoughts on that issue?
Well, the way that the argument is couched is Stromberg error. And Stromberg error is a U.S. Supreme Court case that talks about jury instructions. And what happened in that case, and has been followed by our court here, is if there's error in the jury instructions, it makes the conviction unconstitutional or invalid. The argument here for Stromberg error is insufficiency of the evidence, which is a matter of law, is not ground for Stromberg error. Our case is the case about afterthought robbery. And there's a controversy about whether that created a valid theory of felony murder.
Right, that's Ney. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Ney.
Yeah.
And I can't remember exactly how the court came down on that.
Well, court concluded that, you know, that you have to have the robbery intent before the murder takes place, whereas if it's a murder and then somebody after he's dead that says, oh, let me grab his wallet, you know, and take it, that wouldn't qualify for felony murder. But I believe that's the gist of
it. But to my dismay, it's being emasculated, Ney.
Okay. I couldn't remember the
in favor of the prosecution.
Anyway, the fact that the argument is that one theory of conviction in this case rests on insufficient evidence, but that's not a Stromberg error. So that's when we look at Shad, alternating theories of liability. And here, there's no question about the validity of felony murder. There may be an argument here about premeditated and deliberate murder because Mr. Goodlow was not the trigger man as far as the fatal wound is concerned.
He shot the victim in the leg.
He shot the victim in the leg during what I like to call as a pas de deux.
Which, my French is not too good, so what's that mean?
It's a two-step between two people in a dance. Oh. And if you've watched the video of this case, it's fascinating. These two guys are on the balcony of the Lido, which is on the corner of Arlington and 4th in Reno. I drive by there all the time. And these two guys are going around each other. One is poking the gun in while the other is turning the curtain repeatedly. And they turn around, Goodlow in particular. He does a mule kick against the door to try to kick the door in. And back and forth they go for literally 6 minutes.
And their arms were inside the window?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of the defenses was that perhaps Mr. Goodlow had killed the victim and his dead body was resting against the door, which is completely incoherent because people armed with guns don't point their guns inside a window at a dead guy. If he's dead, there's no reason to go through this pas de deux. But that's exactly what they did. So as far as the sufficiency of the evidence is concerned, and I will just say this, regardless of the deferential standard of review, you don't have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state in this case. These men are guilty beyond any reasonable doubt by overwhelming evidence. So this is not a Stromberg problem. It is arguably a Shad issue on the theory of premeditated and deliberate murder because Mr. Goodlow is not the trigger man. He's an aider and abettor, and he's guilty of felony murder. So in answer to the Stromberg-Shad question, the answer is there's no error here.
So. Your time's up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Petty, you have 3 minutes and 26 seconds, and I'm going to give you an extra minute. So you have 4 minutes and 26 seconds.
Well, thank you very much, Justice Cherry. I want to go back first to, well, actually, I'm going to start with the improper comments and simply say this, that there may be a feeling by this court that after Judge Kosich had made his comments and then there was a break for lunch and they returned for lunch and there was the motion for mistrial, that the court then came out and did sort of a sui sponte instruction of the jury about the impropriety of those remarks and don't take them seriously. That's not what happened. That's not the way I read the record. The way I read the record is they had their hearing, their motion for mistrial hearing, and Judge Kosich disagreed that it was that what you said was had any significant impact and denied the request for the mistrial, but then said, but you know what, I'm not going to talk about that. You fellows don't want me to talk about that because when I do that, it gets me in trouble. And then right out of the box, he's got a juror who he's been sort of doing an exchange with, and he himself, not to the panel as a whole, but just this particular jury, begins to say, you didn't take what I said about Ho Chi Minh and Adolf Hitler and Saddam Hussein. You're not going to use that against these guys, are you? So it wasn't a situation where he instructed the panel to take his remarks and disregard them. He simply focused on this particular juror and engaged in him about how that might have affected him. By the way, was later excused by the judge. So it wasn't like he went back and corrected that. On the Batson issue, I want to say this.
I think just a quick question though.
But the appropriate, that I used to refer to it as a stock jury instruction, was given ultimately later in the trial with respect to anything. If I've said anything here that it's indicated my bias or prejudice, that was given.
Certainly, it was together with I think 35 other jury instructions. Yeah, it wasn't given during at any time contemporaneous with the event.
Okay.
It was done several days later with all the other jury matters. And, you know, you all have been district court trial judges. How odd is it that you are in the, and how odd must it be for a juror? Here's a juror shows up for jury selection in a criminal case, and out of the blue, this judge, who we look to as jurors for direction and guidance, is talking about Hitler and Ho Chi Minh and Saddam Hussein and how he can't hate them. What is that supposed to mean? I mean, goodness gracious, we could all probably put up a variety of explanations on that, but what the effect on the jury might be, we'll never know. And that corrective instruction days later together with all the other instructions, I think was insufficient. I want to go back to the Batson thing because Mr. Hattelstead says that explanations offered up by the prosecution were race neutral and therefore no harm, no foul. That may be true with regards to step two, because the explanation offered up by the prosecutor need not be rational or plausible as long as it isn't inherently discriminatory, as long as it isn't inherently racial. That explanation can be accepted. It is step three where the judge has to make a determination, a credibility determination, based on a sensitive inquiry of the totality of the circumstances as to whether or not those justifications or those explanations are in fact worthy of credibility or are pretexts. And in this case, as I said, the fact that the prosecutor would use one peremptory challenge to take out somebody, an African-American, who mathematically would never have been seated, shows purposeful discrimination. Now, on the severance issue, it was actually a situation where the state had moved to join two separate cases. Mr. Goodloe's case was proceeding along. Mr. Smith's case was proceeding along. The state moved to join those for purposes of trial. Mr. Goodloe opposed that on the basis of antagonistic defense and a variety of other reasons. One issue didn't really develop. And also because it would then turn Mr. Smith into a second prosecutor, which in fact it did. Because if you read the trial transcripts, you'll see that the whole theory of Mr. Smith was that it was Mr. Goodloe who was the culprit, not he. There was a sentencing issue that I also raised that I'm not going to get a chance to talk about. But
what you just mentioned?
A sentencing issue that I raised.
Sentencing, okay.
I know that this court is very deferential to trial courts with regards to sentencing, but that presumes that there has been a rational exercise of sentencing discretion. And I submit when you read this record, there was not a rational exercise of sentencing discretion in this case.
Thank you
for your time.
One more question.
Mr. Petty, on that third part of the Batson test you were talking about there, if the judge didn't do that, could that, since it says steps one and two occurred, could we look at that under a harmless error standard?
I don't think so, because Batson error is an equal protection error.
Mm-hmm.
It is a structural error. Whether or not the prosecutor specifically makes racial justifications, which is clear, which they don't, or whether or not it's a pretext, that is a duty that the trial court has to undertake. And in this case, Judge Kosach did not undertake it one iota. And as a consequence, the credibility determinations of the prosecutor were not made, and there's nothing for this court to be deferential to.
Did the defense counsel point out to Judge Kosach that this third part of the Batson test had not been done and ask him to do it?
You know, no. What happened was the judge had made a ruling. These comments were made to the judge, and this kind of goes to what the question that Justice Cherry had asked Mr. Handelstadt. Was there ever any kind of hearing to sort of flesh this thing out? No, there wasn't. Judge Kosach wanted to get that jury in, and as soon as Mr. Pringleman made his justifications, which were not credited by the judge, Judge Kosach said, thank you. Bring the jury in, and that's all that happened. So it's like the judge ignored his responsibility, or the judge felt that all he had to do was accept whatever Mr. Pringleman said, and let's get going for this trial. And that's error. That's Batson error, sufficient to get a new trial for Mr. Goodloe and Mr. Smith, regardless of the seriousness of the charge or the expense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The panel thanks both lawyers for their excellent arguments, as I expected from both of you. So you lived.